It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And we have a special guest today. It's Usman Malik. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Excellent. Julia, you want to start us off?
Sure. So Usman is a recent Clarion graduate and you're Pakistani-American?
I am a Pakistani-American.
Okay. So were you born here? Did you come over here?
No. So I moved here 6 years ago from Pakistan. I was 24, 25, something like that. And I've been here for about 6-7 years.
Okay.
As you noted, I've not been in the writing business for a long time.
No, he's like pretty brand new. He was just tell us about your Clarion experience, because he was telling me this in the lobby and you missed this.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, I was very young when I started writing, like most of us, and you know, I was in Pakistan, and at that time, this is very early internet time, and there were not a lot of ways to submit from Pakistan to the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. It was not going to happen. So, I mean, even if I wanted to, I couldn't afford the postage. As simple as that. So, I was writing a little bit when I was 16, 17. I submitted to Brutarian, I think.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And I did hear from them for like a year, and then there was a simple two-line forum, and I was like, okay, it's probably not going to happen for me.
I don't think that's really an uncommon story for Brutarian. I think they were notorious for taking a long time to respond.
They've had one of my submissions for 5 years.
Ooh.
I gave up and sent it somewhere else.
Well, you know, like I said, my first convention, it was in 2012, April. It was a World Horror Con. When I was a kid, I used to look at the Bram Stoker Award, and I was like, this is Zeus area. This is like the heaven for people who like horror. This is the Pulitzer for horror writers. And I always thought of myself as a horror writer. And that's kind of what I am in some ways, but I'm also... India and Pakistan have a very long heritage of literary fantastic fiction, which many people don't know about in the West. And so there's an epic called the Dastan-e-Amir Hamza, which was translated by Musharraf Faruqi. It's called The Adventures of Amir Hamza. Came out with Penguin, I believe, in 2004. Strange Horizons did a review of it at some point. And it is considered to be one of the greatest epics, equivalent to the Alif Layla, which is the Arabian Nights, in India, in Pakistan and India. And every kid in Pakistan knows it. I mean, you say the word Amir Hamza, everyone knows that word. It's kind of like saying Shakespeare. That's how famous it is in that part of the world, both India and Pakistan, Urdu-speaking world, and Farsi-speaking world as well. And so Musharraf finally did that translation at some point, came out, I don't think it got much notice in the mainstream, but then Musharraf Ali Faruqi went on to be nominated for the Manasia Booker Prize, and then all of a sudden everyone knows who he is now. And so he's still doing, he is a very interesting person, if you get a chance to look him up. Musharraf Ali Faruqi, and he is digging into old Muslim archives, and he's translating the weirdest stories that you will ever see. It's amazing. He writes for Dawn.com, and that's a big Pakistani newspaper, and he's translating these fantastic vignettes. They're like 2 or 3 pages, but they're stories about this guy who claims he traveled to the sun, right? You know, and he came back and he says, when I got too close, this is why I'm so dark. I got so close. You know, that's the kind of stuff he's translating. Amazing stories that I've never seen in the Western literature. So there is a big treasure trove just waiting to be discovered. And I think a lot of people, Mr. Muhammad Maimon Sahib and Musharraf are doing that. And Maimon is a professor of Urdu studies somewhere in Wisconsin, I think. So these guys are doing that.
Okay.
But unfortunately, the pre-internet, there was no way to connect the two traditions, and now finally it's beginning to happen. So now,
so you said this was, the website is
Don.com? Don.com is the Pakistani news. It's a very famous Pakistani mainstream newspaper, and they do these arts columns. And Musharraf is
and
a regular contributor.
Which language is that in?
It's English.
Okay, so this is actually, we could go and read it.
Absolutely. He's
doing
translations.
How do you spell Don? Is it like D-A-W-N?
D-A-W-N.
Okay.
Okay, just making sure.
And if you Google Don.com and Musharraf Ali Farooqi, and I can spell his name if you like, it's M-U-S-H-A. Double R A F, and then Ali A L I, and Farooqi F A R O O Q I, and he's doing some amazing work. I mean, that is not available in English so far, as far as I know. So he's doing the translations. He actually asked me to translate some point, and I was too busy with my own, you know, stuff. So I said not at this point. He's doing some amazing work. In Pakistan, I don't know. Right now in English, there's any speculative fiction writer working from Pakistan, besides me and a couple of people who finally begin to submit. In Urdu, there is a lot of literature. Besides Amir Hamza, there's a guy, his name is Mazhar Kaleem, who wrote the James Bond series of Pakistan. It's called Ali Imran, the Imran series, and he's published about 1,000 novels in that series. Very famous guy.
Holy cow.
And he's written about 200 children's books. Very prolific writer, writes a novel a month, I think.
Oh my God.
Or he was when I was growing up, and he is one of the most famous, easily recognized names in Pakistan. My dad, when I was young, my dad and I used to read the same book, and so he would hold the book open, and I would stand behind him, and I would read, and so that's how I learned to speed read in Urdu, because if he turned the page, I was gone. So I had to keep up. With him, and so that's how I taught myself to read speed reading in Urdu. Which I've lost that skill, by the way. But he would read, and I would just read along with him. And so that's how, you know, Mazhar has done a lot of work for children's speculative fiction. Amazing work. Very original work.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to look that up. So you mentioned that you have been asked to translate, but I think downstairs you said you had not yet, but that it's something you may be interested in.
Possibly in the future, but translation, I think, is a very different skill from writing in a language originally, because I think the cadences and the rhythms are slightly different, and it's hard to find equivalent words sometimes too. Translation is actually kind of a misnomer. I think Ken Liu mentioned this at some point recently when he was doing Chinese translations. And he said, you know, it's almost like an interpretation that you're doing, less of a translation, because you have to in one of the stories that hopefully will come out at some point. There's a maxim from Urdu. The maxim is the branch, it's about humility. And the maxim is the branch laden with fruit bends the most. Mm. And so that's the kind of stuff that you have to be very careful when you're translating, because otherwise it can be taken in different ways than it was the original context. So maybe sometime in the future. For now, I'm just trying to work in English and see how that goes.
Well, out of curiosity, since what are some of the most difficult processes? I mean, presumably Urdu is the language of choice here.
Yes.
Okay, just making sure I got that right. So what are some of the challenges, that make it most difficult to translate from, say, English into that language, or even going the other way? Like, what are some of the differences in the language that make that difficult?
The scripts are completely different. Urdu is what we call an army language, because it is a language that evolved when, supposedly, a lot of armies from different places got together in one place and needed to communicate. So Urdu evolved from Arabic, Sanskrit, English, and Persian. That's the main mother languages, and that's why people who speak Urdu, especially if they speak not only vernacular Urdu, but a little bit more advanced Urdu, which is called Rekhta, that's old Urdu, if you read poetry in Urdu, there's no way you will not be able to recognize many words in Arabic and Farsi. Urdu, you know, takes a lot of etymology from them. English is a different class of languages. Mm-hmm. Latin, Greek, Spanish, you know, so it has a completely different rhythm. It's written, English is left to right, Urdu is right to left. Scripts are different, and the way you communicate is different. And then you have different types of Urdu. So there are a lot of challenges. When I'm writing my stories right now, the stories that I wrote with Clarion West, four out of my five stories that I wrote were set in Pakistan. And for the foreseeable future, I would do that. It's a deliberate attempt to try to see if I can render that part of the world in speculative fiction, because no one else has done that so far. People have, Mohsen Hamid has written Bapsi Sidwa, Dami Muin and Deen. These people have written mainstream novels, but no one has done speculative fiction. Musharraf has, a little bit, but not in the specfic world. He's doing kind of a, he's coming from a different side, the South Asian literary community side, which becomes like a Borges or a Marquez kind of situation. It's they, you don't consider them speculative anymore.
Right.
They're kind of like the mainstream literary people who are doing ethnic work. So it kind of is a totally different ballgame. No one is doing that in specfic so far, and focusing on that and the genre tradition itself. So that's what I'm trying to do. We'll see how it
ends up. Writing exclusively in English?
I'm writing exclusively in English right now because I've lost most of my Urdu skills.
Oh.
I mean, I speak and write in Urdu, but I'm not good at it anymore. So I need to go back eventually at some point and start, because you need to read in Urdu. I need to revisit that. I will have to read all the texts like Musharraf did. Musharraf was more comfortable in English first. So when he was doing the translation of that extremely difficult book, he had to put like four Urdu dictionaries next to him. And now he's very fluent again, but it's he said it was a chore for him. It was difficult to do that because he had to remember all the traditions, the heritage, the style of old Urdu is so different. The vernacular is different. It's a very strange thing, and there's so much. It's very exciting too, because no one has done that yet. I was talking to Jeff Vandermeer on Facebook a little while ago, and I was Jeff. You know, he does a lot of global work in the weird tradition, and Jeff was like, you know, a few years down the line, if we do an international weird compendium, we'll need your help. And I was like, I don't know them anymore. I'll have to revisit all of them, and I'll have to go through all the Urdu writers, because obviously people like horror in Urdu in Pakistan. My first story was published when I was 15 in an Urdu magazine called Dar, Fear. And so, you know, I mean, people do that. It's just not original work because it's all derivative. There was no continuum. They're riffing off of Dracula and vampires and all the stuff that these writers have heard of. But a highly original horror writer does not exist as far as I know.
So what did you grow up reading? I mean, how did you... Obviously, you're interested in science fiction and fantasy, or else you wouldn't have ended up going to Clarion and wanting to do, like, horror as well. What did you grow up reading, and what was your influence?
I think I must have been 7 or 8 when... I remember this, actually, quite specifically. It was my birthday, and a friend of mine gave me a gift. It was one of Tarzan's in Urdu. And Tarzan is a big, big series. I mean, we don't worry about copyright in that part of the world.
Okay.
So there is an entire series of Superman translated. I mean, it's very clearly Superman. The name is just different. And so there's a series in Urdu for kids. This is all for kids.
Okay.
So I read all these kid books about Tarzan, and then Mazhar Kaleem did a series in Tarzan and Superman with his own names. And then he did a highly original work, which is very original children's literature work. And that's what I learned to love. Absolutely, I was in love with that. And then as I grew up, I read, you know, Urdu classics. I read and understand a little bit of Farsi. And I do understand some Arabic, not too much. So I did have access to that literature, and then I became obsessed with reading it in English, because I wanted to improve my English. I was in a very colonial school, and I was one of the slightly poorer kids because my classmates were children of feudal lords. I mean, they were very rich people, and I was a slightly more middle-class shopkeeper son kind of person. So it was a different situation. I wanted to be able to mingle with them. Their parents had been to Harvard, Stanford. My dad had never gone anywhere outside Lahore. So I wanted to improve my English, and I was taking O-levels, which is the British system of education. And so I just became obsessed with English. That's how. I learned English properly, I think, when I was 12 or 11.
Do your parents speak English?
A little bit. Broken English mostly, but they cannot read English. So they will never be able to read my work.
Oh.
Unless I translate it in a movie.
Okay.
So earlier we were talking to John Chu about his work translating from Chinese to English, and he said that one of the difficulties, he was talking a lot about the things that you had mentioned, Ken, you were saying about translation being really interpretation, and that in Chinese there is a lot of emphasis on nouns, whereas in English we place a lot of emphasis on verbs. So it's a completely different structure. Do you find that there are structural differences between the languages and the way that you form sentences and express things?
A little bit. I think it's more, if you speak Urdu, vernacular Urdu, it's more kind of like, it's upside down a little bit. For example, I'm trying to translate it in my head. Instead of saying he was going, sometimes we'll go, going he was.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes we'll sit, put it upside down just for emphasis. Sometimes that occasionally that will happen. I'm trying to find a better example. I can't. But you will have some, and it's very rhythmic. It's really rhythmic and what you want to say first. My son is 4, and I'm trying to teach him both languages in Urdu, and we try to make sure that he speaks some. He understands perfectly but that he speaks it, and it's English is easier for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see the differences in him trying to learn the languages, and then once upon a time, when I tell him to tell me a story, and I say, tell it to me in Urdu, then he'll try to find ways, and he's trying to put it together using English as a base.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult for him. So there is a little bit of structure differences, but Urdu is not as different from English linguistically or structurally as Chinese might be. Much about Chinese, of course.
No, that's fine. I wasn't asking you to compare it to Chinese. I was just wondering if you noticed structural differences, but you did mention like order. And so is it always an upside-down sort of order, or is it just sometimes?
Occasionally, when it's slangish, mostly.
Okay.
You know, you kind of look for emphasis, you say that first. I did this. I'm trying to figure out how to best... Yesterday I was doing this. Yes, I was.
Okay.
Yesterday
okay.
I was doing this. Yes, I was. Or yesterday I was doing this. I was. You know, it's kind of a just
so
a little touch.
So you add like an extra emphatic sort of
yes.
affirmation on what you were saying.
Kind of like that, yes.
Huh,
okay.
Interesting.
And it's, but it's mostly spoken Urdu. Written Urdu is supposed to be very... It's not stream of consciousness at all. Written
okay.
Urdu is very organized... Very classical, very structured, very formalist.
Okay. Oh, so going back to the literature, since obviously you've read quite a bit and are quite familiar with the literature, what would you say are some major themes or concerns that appear in, if not all, just at least some of the Pakistani literature?
Yeah, all night. We can talk about it all night.
Let's go for it. I got my notes. I'm ready. Let's do it.
Well, in the some of the themes that are extremely interesting in that part of the world, it's more an Eastern theme or more a Central Asian theme. And Urdu literature, like I said, is derived, heavily borrows from Arabic, Sanskrit, Farsi, which is Persian, and English, actually. And so there is a lot of influences. Historically and classically, Arabic literature and Farsi literature has had a lot of influence done by Sufi school of thought. And we were talking about this last night with Kefi. Rumi is I don't know if you guys are familiar with the work of Rumi. So Coleman Barks did a lot of work translating Rumi's verses into English. But for a long time, Rumi was one of the phrase, whirling like a dervish, comes from Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the greatest influences on all sorts of Indian, Pakistani, Central Asian, Turkish, Arabic, Farsi countries. Everyone knows the word Rumi. We call him with respect Maulana Rum, the one from Rum, the Maulana from Rum. And he's considered one of the great figures of our history and literature. And so we have the themes that Rumi touched upon are extremely versatile, but his biggest one was divine love. And so I grew up reading a lot of poetry in Urdu, and I was quite well-versed in it at one time. And then because of the clash, the evolution of cultural changes that were happening as the world began to change, and as that part of the world started lagging behind, there was a lot of nostalgia to return to the golden past, which never existed. There's never a golden past. But unfortunately, that's what we all assume. Everyone wants to, you know, not face the present, and they've said, oh, we had a golden past. True to some degree, but not always. Not perfection. Not perfect, at least. And so, there's a lot of theme about nostalgia, about the great past. There's a lot of talk about, especially in poetry and nationalist poetry, about going back to the ways of yore.
Mm-hmm.
Love of all sort is a big theme. You can read, just like in English, you can read Urdu poetry or Farsi poetry, and there are like 7 layers of meaning. and you need to know the context or to which the work is referring to. So when they talk about loving a woman or a man, there's always the idea that that can be easily interpreted to be divine love. And so Rumi's idea of love was always, he always talked about Shams. In fact, I was talking to David about, Kefi about this, the idea of homosexuality and same-sex love is extremely predominant in Rumi's work. And people say it's Platonic work. You talk to different people, they'll say different things. And Rumi always used to say, he's the shadow of God for me. Shams was the beggar that changed him from an orthodox scholar into a blind, whirling lover who would dance to the tune of God's song. He would go to the marketplace, and there would be goldsmiths working and you know, clattering on with wooden, steel stools. And he would start whirling in ecstasy. So the idea was divine ecstasy, divine love. And that literature is so predominant that now growing up, we all wanted to be annihilated by that love.
Okay.
All the kids, you know, the idea of love is so heavy, it's so non-physical. There's a huge divine thing, theme going on in it all the time. The idea of love is very non-physical. It's very, it's that idea of a perfect soulmate or who will, Iqbal, who's a very famous poet, one of the great poets in Urdu, used to say that the way to God was through a woman. And the, loving a woman or loving whoever your partner might be is the way to God. And so that's a very predominant theme. Other themes would be, obviously, you know, Islamic history, nationalist struggles, what else? I mean, and all the global themes that we're familiar with. But that's a, that's some of the stuff that I read
so,
quite a bit.
So everyone pretty much has read Rumi where you're from. This is
or at least they're familiar with the name.
Because I think here it's something that has become very popular and maybe has kind of reached its peak and sort of faded a little bit. But a few years ago, I remember you could go into like the Whole Foods grocery store,
yep,
and they would have Rumi calendars where there would be Rumi poems on each month. And this was something that we wanted to, we were very excited about this Eastern consciousness. And
yes,
it's funny because we seem to latch on as a culture, in a mainstream culture, to different parts of the world and like have this brief sort of love affair with that particular, whatever aspect of it. But I think that's probably why most people here would know Rumi at this point.
If they knew the name at all, they probably would because...
But I think a lot of people would because like I think there was like chocolate bars and tea that you could get, and it would have like the tea bag would have a little saying, and it's like this, you know, this is a little clip of Rumi's advice.
It's a weird, like, commodification of a philosophy.
Yeah, and it's. I think that's one of the places where, when we talk about cultural appropriation and the idea of the separation between cultural appropriation and cultural exchange, and you're saying that there are people who are doing a lot of work to bring Rumi into English.
Yes.
And here, I think that we as a culture recognize that there was this value in it, but then sort of, instead of actually looking deeply at it, skimmed the surface of it and said, okay, well, this is a pretty picture, let's be done with it.
Well, you know, it's kind of, it's almost Rumi has kind of become, in some people that I've talked to, they think of him almost as synonymous with New Age consciousness.
That's definitely the way it was here.
So it's, you know, Leslie Howell, who's Faryn West's instructor, when I wrote to Leslie in my application, you know, you're supposed to say why you're applying. And so when I applied, you know, I got in, and then we were, all the students were exchanging emails, and then we were talking about what kind of stuff we read. And I mentioned Rumi, and Leslie wrote me a private email. And she said, I have had yet to have had a clear in class in which someone mentioned Rumi, and she's a big fan of Rumi.
Okay.
So we talked about Rumi all the time, then that's what she said. You know, that I think there's a part of that is also that New Age satisfies a certain need for particular people.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a spiritual need, it can be a need, a cultural need, it can be sometimes, I don't know, I mean, it has some, there is definitely an element of all, one of the reasons why we like speculative fiction is the idea of being awed. Awe is a big part of science fiction, and that's why science fiction is the fiction of ideas. That idea that just completely blow you away. And
the idea
see,
that you want a sense of wonder.
Yes, touching that peculiar thing that we're not in touch with anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rumi fulfills that need for many, many people. And the good thing about Rumi is because of that Shams, and if you read him up, you will discover the idea of Rumi and Shams, the idea of same-sex love, was very, I think it was very much welcomed by certain people, and people who wanted to talk about that acceptance historically as well. And there are scholars of Islam who actually look at that and who are very accepting of that, and they like that because it, to them, gives them an anchor, a different anchor from the Orthodox Islam that some people are used to. And so when I was growing up, when I first read that, it made me very happy. It reminded me that there, if even if I believed in God, there could be the possibility of a tolerant God and accepting God. So I did not have to worry about all the Orthodox thou shalt this anymore. So it gives a lot of people room for spirituality in their life, regardless of what you believe in.
It's interesting. I never really thought about like New Age sort of spiritual or mysticism, whatever they kind of call it. I never really thought of it as fulfilling that maybe a spiritual need. But it makes total sense when you think about it, that it does.
Well, I think that one of the reasons that I think it's so popular right now here and has been for the last 20 or 30 years is because there have been a lot of people, I think, when my mother was a child, for instance, I think most people that she knew would have gone to church every Sunday. And that was just the way it was throughout the country in most places. And that now, like by the time I was a child, maybe half the people in my class would go to church every Sunday, to different churches. But there were a lot of people who weren't. And even people who maybe said they still were Christian would not necessarily go to church. And when you lose that, what you're looking for with religion is this idea that faith can give you maps for figuring out the emotional landscape of your life, because there are so many challenges that you face. And when you stop having that anchor, you have to find something else, to some other map.
Sure.
So then,
and this is one,
then when people stop going to church, because there are various reasons that people would stop with that, that part of it is the idea that maybe it's too constricting. So I don't agree with the values of this particular thing, or I don't want to spend my time being yelled at by a preacher or something like that. Then it's like, okay, well, if I don't want to do that, what do I want, and how do I find my way through the darkness?
I can offer a way. My mom engaged a little bit in, I'm not sure what it was, some version of New Age in the early 90s, late 80s. She would burn incense, and she would listen to Enigma and Enya and other kinds of, like, that New Age music that was around in the late 80s in the U.S., at least. I don't know if it was anywhere else, but she would go through, she now is, I don't know, she's Christian, but she doesn't go to church, and I think it's mostly because of what you talked about, is she can't seem to find a church that, wherever she lives, that is what she's looking for, that fulfills what she needs, so she's just found other ways to get at it. She still listens to, like, New Agey music, whatever that
and
is.
And I think
it's
very popular in a lot of places. I mean, Enya is Irish. And very popular in Ireland. I don't think that she's just popular in America.
Oh, sure,
I think Enigma was, like, Swedish or something. Maybe Swiss? Anyway,
this New Age
music
one song
was all
the
over the place. It wasn't limited to one country at all.
Yep. Sure. I just meant, like, it just felt so concentrated. Like, all of a sudden, there's this New Age station
in
California. I feel like
the 90s was a real nexus of it. And we had, like, Lorena McKennitt, who is Canadian, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right, yeah.
So all of these different places that were kind of coming together with that.
It was a bit different for me, because I wanted to listen to, like, rock and roll. And she's like, let's listen to this easy listening New Age stuff.
Well, you know, you can find spirituality in Led Zeppelin.
I know. This is true.
It's true. So,
straight over to heaven.
So did you... what kind of culture did you grow up in? Was there a lot of New Age culture around you?
I grew up in a very Orthodox culture, a very conservative culture. Well, I shouldn't say conservative, but in a very religious family. I grew up with about 12 or 16 cousins in a large house, with a joint family system. My father lived in the same house as some of his brothers did, and my grandparents. So when I grew up, I was very used to a joint family system, and that's what I want for my kid eventually, if I ever move back. But it was very, very secure. It was very comforting. And I have very happy, if somewhat lonely, memories of my childhood occasionally, because I was the youngest. They would pick on me. I was the last one to be picked for cricket, which I did not like. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of the way we all are. That's why we're writers. But, or at least I am. So, you know, I grew up in that world, and my... It was... There was... there was a very great current of spirituality in our house. We used to go for Juma on Friday every week, and my granddad was a very respected figure in that mosque. And I remember that, you know, bad, but there was a line of beggars, and they all knew my granddad. And he would go, and my grandfather, my barebu, would go, and he would, you know, give money to each and every person. And when he died, we discovered that he used to give money monthly to many people who came to our house and said, we haven't received our money. Mm-hmm. And then that's when they discovered that he had passed away. We never knew about it. Mm-hmm. So he was a very old school kind of person, a very, very old school kind of person. So either way, we, on Thursday night, which they call the Night of the Saints, some of my family members would go to shrines. In Lahore, there's a very famous person. His name is Ali Hajweri, Data Ganjbaksh, the one who gives you creditors. In his shrine, some of my family members used to go there and spend the night there. And I was in Minneapolis in 2007, and I was about to get my driver's license for the first time. And this guy who's sitting at the counter, he looks at my hometown and says, "You're from Lahore? The land of the great Ali Hajweri?" He's a white guy. I'm like, "How did you know?" I'm like, "My wife is from Iran. I want to go there. That's my dream, to go to Lahore." And I was like, I lived there all my life. Ali Hajweri is like Rumi for some people. And so, you know, he's a very, very big saint. And people who know Sufism, at least, he's a big figure. And that's where they used to go every Thursday night, to spend the night and, you know, pray and meditate and do whatever they wanted. So we grew up in that part, but we were never Orthodox to the point, or at least my parents weren't. I did not pray five times a day. I should have, but I did not. I still don't. I should.
But you have the guilt.
I have the great Catholic / Islamic guilt.
I was like, you sound like the equivalent of the Pakistani version of Catholic guilt.
That's
here.
Exactly right. So I have that guilt, and I have that sensibility and that understanding of why people want that. Mm-hmm. It is very, very comforting. It's very secure. And my feeling, the feeling in my heart is very spiritual when I think about it. So, you know, Orhan Pamuk, who wrote My Name is Red, Nobel Prize winner, someone once asked him what kind of Muslim he was, and he said, "I'm a cultured Muslim." Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he's agnostic or atheist, I'm not sure, but he said, "I'm a cultural Muslim. I'm very connected to my history and culture. I'm a little bit more than that, but I'm still not Orthodox." But my family was. My cousins are still very Orthodox. Some of them have long beards. They pray five times a day, sometimes six times a day. And I did that at 4 in the morning. I would sometimes wake up, my cousin would knock on the window. I would go, we'd go to the mosque, we'd pray, we'd come back, talk about Islam, the history. And it was beautiful. It was a great, beautiful, the 90s was a good time for us. Post 9/11, things changed. Mm-hmm. It was all of a sudden, you know, everything kind of crashed for everyone, not just, you know, for Pakistan. It was for everyone. But it was, we were very secure. We understood who we were. We had no trouble with anyone. The U.S. or the West, there was never the idea of anyone being the enemy. And I loved Superman when I was a kid. I watched it. You know, all of us watched these movies. I read superhero comics. I read Archie was actually more than my thing, because we did not have those series of superhero comics. I couldn't follow them. So I just gave up after a couple. But, you know, we read all these books. I haunted old bookshops. I picked up Peter Straub's, I think it was Ghost Story, at an old bookshop and fell in love with him. And then I picked up Stephen King and Ramsey Campbell and those bookshops, and I would haunt them. Those were the ones I could afford. So it was both cultural, it was both religious, it was literary for us too, because my parents are avid readers. My dad is an avid reader in Urdu. So, you know, that's kind of the background I have.
So we're going to circle right back around to the beginning, because you mentioned this horror stuff, and you started to tell us your experience of how you came into the writing side of things in the U.S.,
yes.
Where you went to the horror convention in 2012. And then earlier you were telling me how you ended up going to Clarion and what your experience has been with all this. But I think we got sidetracked and you didn't even get to the point where you talked about what the horror convention was like.
It was my first convention ever. I had never been to a convention before. I did not know what conventions meant. So I Googled it. My brother was here in April 2012. He'd left and I was heartbroken because I was missing my family. And I couldn't go because I didn't have my green card yet. So when he left, I was just sitting there. I remember I was devastated. I just wanted him to stay, especially for my son. He really misses his uncle. So I was there, and I just knew I needed to do something to, you know, keep me occupied. So I Googled World Horror Convention, or Bram Stoker Award, and I figured it was next week. And I was like, I don't care. I'm going to go. I've never done anything like this before in my life. I want to go. So that's how literally I came into writing, because I went to the convention. I attended a workshop by Mort Castle, who's become a good friend of mine since. And Mort, you know, I wrote a story when I was 17 or 18, I don't remember how old, And I, that was the only story I had written in about 15 years. And I had to submit it for critique. So I submitted it, I think it was $20 or something. So I submitted it. He critiqued it. And after the workshop, he kind of, you know, talked to me and said, you're very close. And I said, I wrote it when I was 16 years old. So he was like, no, you need to keep writing. So I came, I met Linda Addison, who's a Bram Stoker Award winner, and she writes poetry, and Marge Simon, who's here actually. And so Linda bought a poem of mine at the convention. She said, you know, you have anything I can look at? We were in this poetry circle, and I read my poem again, which I wrote about 15 years ago. So I read that, she bought a poem of mine, gave me $5 for it, and I'm like, oh, people actually want to read this stuff. It's not just me. I'm not crazy.
And then you learn how lucrative. I also have done a little bit of science fiction and fantasy poetry, so you learn how lucrative science fiction and fantasy poetry is.
Yes, I did.
$5.
$5. Pro-rex, baby. So I came home. I wrote a story. I submitted it to Paul Jeunesse. He was doing a Crimson Pact mythology series.
I know, Paul.
I sold it. Actually, in 3 days, I sold it. It was my first semi-pro sale in fiction. He's gave me $50 for it, I think. And so I sold that, I sold him another story, and then I started submitting, and I obviously started getting rejected, because I had no idea what I was doing. I did not know what cover letters were, I did not know what the word slush reader meant, I did not know how you wrote a cover letter, so I knew nothing. So I started submitting, started getting rejected, sent a story to Nightmare, an extremely horrible story, Nightmare, and I got a form like in like 20 minutes.
That's because that you JJA is amazing. Like, really, we always say that you can submit to Lightspeed so you can get rejected at Lightspeed.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I got a form, and I was like, that's okay. And so I sent one to DSF. I got a form. But when I submitted my next one, they bought it. And that was pre-Clarion, actually. So that was my first pro sale to Daily Science Fiction. It was a riff of DSF. It was a magic realism story about T.S. Eliot's poem. What's the long one?
The Wasteland?
No, the other one.
The
Love Song
of
G.A. for Prufrock.
Oh, yes. Prufrock. Okay.
So it was a story that I wrote magically in which all the imagery actually came alive. So I sold her DSF, and then I applied to Clarion, and I got in, which I did not expect at all. So I went to Clarion West in Seattle, 6 weeks, amazing people in my class. I mean, Lily Yu is in my class. David Edison, whose book has just came out from Poor,
yeah,
was in my class.
We talked to him.
Shannon Peavy, who won Writers of the Future, was in my class.
So you have a really amazing class.
Helena Bell is
my
class.
Oh, wow, yeah, you did have a really amazing class.
It was a great class. I learned, it was the time of my life. If I could go back, I would. But that's a bad thing. You should never do that again. So I would, it changed me forever as a writer. I started understanding better what I was doing. Pre-Clarion, I had gotten to the point just by writing and submitting and reading that I was already getting personals. Mm-hmm. And I got a couple of personals from Shimmer. I got a couple of personals from, you know, I hadn't submitted FNSF yet, but from Nightmare, and then I sold to DSF. I got a personal from Strange Horizons. It was a story that Ellen Datlow really liked, but it's realist. And it was very understandable why there was no speculative element in it. But Clarion really taught me how to read, which I did not know before, because I had never read analytically before. No one had taught me. And so I finally discovered how to read. I did not know what the shape of the story was supposed to be like. I always could put words together, which means nothing. So you need to know the shapes of stories. You need to know what voice is. And I had a voice. I always had a voice in the last few years because I've been reading very heavily. So I've already had a very strange subcontinental voice. But that really started getting better. And then, you know, if I never publish again, I will always say I made Chip Delaney cry with the story.
That's a wonderful
I made Chip Delaney cry. I wrote a story. It was my first week story at Clarion, which I wrote for Neil Gaiman. And Chip said, you can give me two stories, I'll read two of them. So I gave him that one, and he read, and he took me aside the next day, and he said, you made me cry. I was crying like a baby, and I was happy to be crying.
Aww.
So if I never publish again, I will take this to my grave.
I feel like that's a victory.
I will take this to my grave. And then that story sold nowhere. Because whenever I send it to literary markets, Chip was like, start off with the Paris Review. So I sent it to the Paris Review, and I got forums, then I started, I got personal honor from everywhere. But it was probably just not for them. It was a literary story, very literary story, with a heavy metaphorical magic realism element in it. I tried three places, and then Michael Bailey, who's a Borderlands, Tom Monteleone's Borderland graduate. He was looking for science fiction stories, and he had bought my Clarion West submission story, Blood Women, which is actually coming out from Pseudopod next month.
Okay.
So I resorted to Pseudopod, so it's coming out next month. And Michael said, do you have anything in dark science fiction? And I said, well, I have this story that's sitting at a couple of literary markets, and if you want it, I'll send it to you. If you like it, you can buy it, and I'll withdraw it from them, because it's simultaneous submission. So I sent it, and he bought it in 2 days. And so I was like, I should have tried maybe Shimmer and SH with it, but then I was like, well, you know, it's fine. I'll write more. So it's been a good couple of few months, but I think the kind of setting that I have, it's not going to be easy to really tell the kind of stories I want to tell and sell them in a way that makes me happy. Because there's some of them are really weird, strange stories, and they're not Asimov material, for example. And I know that till I write a story that will fit that market, for example. Because some of them are very strange stories, and they are set differently, they're told differently, they're very thematic. So we'll see how it goes.
I'm sorry, I just want to keep track of time. Okay, we're good. Are we? What time did we start?
I don't know. I think we're at a pretty good wrapping up point.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of conversation.
Yeah.
It's been really interesting.
Excellent.
So before we go, where can people find you and your work?
I do not have a website yet, and I have a very old blog, which I don't use. I do contribute to a South Asian magazine. It's called Desi Writers Lounge, and the website is www.desiwritersLounge.net. And I've contributed a couple of articles and a couple of stories to them. I interviewed Ellen Datlow for that magazine, and Charlie Jane Andes picked it up for
IO9. Nice.
So that's where I'm very active. I talked to the Pakistani and Indian writers on that forum. I asked them all to apply to Korean and Odyssey this year. So I don't know. I hope someone gets in, so we can have more, you know, diverse writers from that part of the world. Because I think I'm probably the first Pakistani graduate of Korean, period. I don't think there's anyone been before me. So I want more people from that part of the world to come. India is already doing a bunch. Sri Lanka has had some writers, but not Pakistan so far. So people can find me there, and hopefully I'll sell some more.
And what was your story that was in Daily Science Fiction?
It's called Pinned and Wriggling on the Wall.
Okay.
It's one of the verses in...
Pinned and Wriggling on the Wall, and I'm assuming that was already out, so we could look
that
up.
Yes, it's on Daily Science Fiction.
Okay.
It's under Usman T. Malik. And my other story that's coming out from Pseudopod is called Blood Women, and it was first published in Kyle Matt 2 by Michael Davey.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to
us. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, sorry. I was writing notes. Cause I was like, note. But yeah, thank you. Especially since it came just like, it was sudden.
Yes.
So, yeah, so I really appreciate
it. This might be the worst ending ever.
Hey.
We're still laughing.
You're just taking all of my self-esteem and just, I'm like, I don't have any left, Julia. It's all right.
Okay, we'll throw you into the room, and we'll all come back.
And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.